Yeah, thanks for having us, observers. I've been asked to talk about multi-wavelength electromagnetic counterparts of gravitational wave events, which, as we all know, means GW170817. I'll try to go a little bit beyond that. I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes about kind of broadly why we want to find electromagnetic counterparts. I think we've already gotten a flavor for that in the talks earlier today. I'll talk about GW170817, kind of spanning from gamma rays down to radio. I'll talk a little bit about EM follow-up in O3 so far. There is not much of it, but I think there are kind of interesting results already. I'll talk a little bit about something that we have not talked about yet, which is looking at the question of host galaxies of binary neutron star mergers, and what we can learn from those about how these systems actually formed and about the delay time distribution. Okay, there are quite a few reasons why we want to find electromagnetic counterparts for gravitational wave events. Obviously, going from large localization on the sky down to a precise position enables a measurement of precise distance, of redshift, gives us the host galaxy and the context for these mergers, the astrophysical context. Of course, we also learn about the behavior of matter after the merger itself, something we cannot assess directly from gravitational wave data, and something about the nature of the remnant. For example, in the case of GW170817, we know very well from gravitational wave data that the mass of the remnant is 2.74 solar masses, but we don't really know whether that's a neutron star or a black hole, right? This is information we can gather from electromagnetic observations. Going a few years back, Brian and I looked at a variety of possible electromagnetic signatures that will accompany binary neutron star mergers or neutron star black hole mergers. I don't want to go into this in detail. I think, you know, we've gotten a flavor from this from GW170817. The point is that even before that event, it was relatively clear that there would be quite a wide range of electromagnetic manifestations spanning the entire electromagnetic spectrum, that some of these counterparts would be beamed, some would be isotropic, and some would come from relativistic versus non-relativistic outflows. Really, we have this kind of complex picture where what we see from a merger will depend both on the nature of the objects that are merging, as well as on our viewing angle, and questions that are still not fully understood, whether a relativistic jet forms every time, whether it manages to punch out of the ejecta, and things like that. The remarkable thing about GW170817 is that it essentially exhibited every single one of these predictions, and I think that's incredibly rewarding for the first event. It remains to be seen whether that will be the case generally. We've seen already the gravitational wave and gamma ray data for GW170817. I think the key thing here to remember is again, the gravitational wave data gives us the masses of the two objects that merge, so somewhere in the range of 1.4 solar masses. It again doesn't tell us what these objects are. For the sake of argument, one could stand up here and say that these were two black holes or one black hole and one neutron star, right? There's nothing in the gravitational wave data that prevents that. Same for the final object. We don't know if it's a black hole or a neutron star. This is the kind of information that we hope to get from electromagnetic observations. Now, the gamma ray signal that was detected in association with this event, it was clear right away that there was something unusual about this because of the distance estimate, somewhere between 25 and 50 megaparsecs. Again, just from the gravitational wave information, it was clear that the gamma ray emission was about 10 to the 5 times less energetic than a typical short gamma ray burst. Okay. Now there are various ways of interpreting this, shown in this diagram here from one of the LIGO papers. The point is that in isolation, without additional information, the nature of the gamma ray emission is very difficult to determine by itself. Ryan talked about the electromagnetic counterparts. Here's the image that he showed from the galaxy-targeted approach. The other approach that worked for finding the counterpart here was essentially the brute force tiling the entire region, which again was relatively small compared to anything we've seen before that event and since then. I think the question remains whether these approaches are going to scale for the larger distances of detections that we are encountering now and will encounter in the future. I'll talk a bit more about that when I get to O3 results. This is a nice compilation from a paper that was led by Ashley Villar of all the optical UV optical infrared follow-up of GW170817. You can see quite complex behavior with very rapid fading from an initially UV bright, blue optical emission bright component to much longer term infrared emission that took several days to rise to peak brightness, then stayed flat and faded away on a time scale of about a month. And it turns out that in order to explain this complex behavior temporally and in terms of color evolution requires more than just a single component of radioactive material. So we have ejecta properties that span a wide range of velocities, masses, nucleosynthesis, and possibly geometry, which is something that we cannot assess with a single event, but there is reason to suspect that these different components are not all spherically symmetric and embedded with each other. So in kind of broad terms, we can explain this complicated data set with essentially two basic components. One is a low opacity or low lanthanide fraction component of the ejecta that contains about 0.02 solar masses and with a velocity of about 0.3 C. And that dominates the early UV and blue optical emission and then fades away rapidly. And then a second component that dominates the long-term infrared emission with a larger ejecta mass of about 0.05 solar masses, which has a higher opacity, higher lanthanide fraction, and ejecta velocity of about 0.1 C. So that comes purely from just modeling the time behavior and the color evolution of the kilonova counterpart. Now we can also take a look at the spectra, and here the spectra show similar very rapid evolution. So in the optical regime, the optical spectra are essentially featureless, starting in at about 12 hours after the event and spanning for about 3 or 4 days when the optical emission dominates. And by comparison to models for what the spectral energy distribution looks like, we can infer that the fact that they're featureless points to very high velocity. So everything, and any features that are there are completely Doppler broadened and smoothed out. And so this comparison to models shows an ejecta mass of about 0.03 solar masses, a velocity of about 0.3 C, and a very low lanthanide fraction, somewhere between 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 4. So that agrees nicely with what we infer from modeling the optical light curve. In the infrared, the story is different. So the infrared spectra, which become dominant after a few days, show these broad features, but very clear features, that are indicative of a lower velocity, so about 0.1 C, again, by comparison to these models, and an ejecta mass of about 0.04 solar masses, and in this case, a higher lanthanide fraction of about 1%. Okay, so again, that agrees with what we infer from just the overall evolution of the infrared light as a function of time. Okay, so these are all great numbers. What can we actually learn from this information? So one thing that I think has become so obvious that I don't think anybody actually states this anymore is that we have direct evidence for R-process nucleosynthesis in 170817, both from the nature of the emission and its evolution, but also from spectroscopic features. If we take the ejecta masses that are inferred here, especially the lanthanide-rich component that appears to have gone through potentially second and third peak of the R-process, and we multiply it by the current estimate of the binary neutron star merger rate, now both of these numbers have large uncertainties associated with them, but in any case, just multiplying these two numbers provides us with the amount of R-process material that we need in order to explain the galactic inferred values. What's also interesting, and I think that has not been appreciated so much so far, is that if we take the ratio of mass that we infer for the lanthanide-rich and lanthanide-poor components, and we compare that to the relative abundance of R-process material with atomic masses above 140 and below 140, we get the right ratio. It gives us the right ratio of about 20% or so. Okay, so it's not just that where this event seems to generate R-process material, it seems to generate it in the right ratios to explain the galactic values. Now we can make other inferences. These are somewhat more speculative and mainly done essentially by comparison to models, and we've heard some about this before. So this lanthanide poor ejecta component with a velocity of about 0.3 C seems to be generated from material at the collision interface between the two events, and that seems to naturally implicate two objects with a surface, so two neutron stars, rather than a neutron star black hole merger or for the sake of argument, the black hole merger. So I think the presence of this ejecta component actually allows us to break some of the degeneracy that exists from just the gravitational data alone. In a similar way, this lanthanide-rich ejecta component that has a velocity of about 0.1 c seems to most naturally be explained as a wind that's being driven off of an accretion disk because of the relatively low velocities. The fact that it exhibits a high lanthanide fraction suggests that if there was a phase of a hypermassive neutron star, that phase had to be relatively short, so that neutrino irradiation from that neutron star did not completely raise the electron fraction to very high values and suppress the production of lanthanides. So again, by comparison to models, we can argue that that neutron star lasted for at most of order a tenth of a second or so. Okay, so it tells us that the final state of the merger was a black hole. It did not form promptly, probably formed after a tenth of a second or so, but it is a black hole that's left at the end of that process, not a very massive neutron star. Okay, so that's the optical and infrared. We heard about the radio earlier. What I'm showing here is the combination of radio and X-ray, as well as late time optical light curves. So the optical emission dies off very quickly, but then we pick it up a second time around 100 days, where now that optical emission is essentially pure, smoothly connected from all the way from the radio to X-rays, as you can see in this plot. So I think what's important here is not just that the shape and the evolution are consistent with a structured jet interpretation for this emission, but also that we're seeing a single emission component that extends with a single power law all the way from radio to X-rays. We don't see a second break that's due to synchrotron cooling. And that allows us to place a constraint on the density of the surrounding environment. Okay, so if the density was higher than about 10 to the minus 3 particles per cubic centimeter, we would see, we would expect to see a break between the radio and X-rays due to synchrotron cooling. The fact that we do not see that even out to a timescale of about a year places a constraint on the kind of parsec scale density around this merger. And this value is generally typical of what we see for short duration gamma ray bursts. So in addition to just telling us this is an event, a binary neutron star merger generated a jet that looks like a short GRB jet, it also lived in an environment that's typical of short GRBs. Okay, and I think we've heard about this from Kunal, that we expect that the kilonova ejecta itself, as it interacts with that same medium, would provide its own radio and X-ray signature on a later timescale as it sweeps up enough material to decelerate and produce a signature. And the nice thing here is that we have an independent estimate. We have an estimate for the density from the existing radio and X-ray observations. We have an estimate of the ejecta mass and velocity from the kilonova modeling, and that should allow us to generally predict what that signature should be. And so by measuring it, we can have an independent check on these numbers. So we can go after these parameters in multiple ways. Okay, so let me touch on follow-up in O3. So there have been so far two events that potentially would have had an electromagnetic counterpart. S190425 is a BNS merger at a distance of about 150 megaparsecs, localized to about 1/6 of the sky or so, and with a false alarm rate of about 1 in 70,000 years. So that seems like a legitimate binary neutron star merger that unfortunately was detected when only one of the LIGO detectors was on. And you can see the localization region shown here, but the distance is about 4 times larger than for GW170817. The second event that generated interest and follow-up, it happened a day later. It's a possible neutron star black hole, or maybe black hole binary neutron star merger at 375 megaparsecs. Again, localized to an area in the sky that's quite large, about 1,100 square degrees. This time, the false alarm rate is very marginal, close to what LIGO announces publicly. And so it's not even clear if this is a real detection or not. But again, there was quite a lot of follow-up observations of that. So what I'm showing here is just a compilation of follow-up that we carried out, plus things reported by the community, in comparison to the light curves of GW170817, but now shifted to the distance of this event, 190425, at a distance of 155 megaparsecs. And what you can see is that There's been quite a range of follow-up observations, reaching a range of limiting magnitudes and taking different approaches of targeting individual galaxies, covering a wide field. And you can see that some of these observations actually do go deep enough to really potentially find a counterpart if it was similar to GW17 or 817. Unfortunately, none of these searches managed to cover the entire area, and so it's hard to say what's there. The other panel shows other alternative models, one where there's an on-axis gamma ray burst, which we only expect in at most a few percent of the cases, or off-axis afterglows, or models where there's only a red kilonova without a blue component. You can see that those are much more difficult to detect. And then this is a similar plot, but now for the second event, which is at 350 megaparsecs, now we can see that quite a few of the searches just did not go deep enough to find a counterpart similar to 17.0817. Nevertheless, there were quite a few candidates that were announced. So here is just a histogram of candidates reported in these localization regions, as well as the expected brightness of GW17 or 817. So you can see that there were candidates announced in the right brightness level, and the ones with solid histograms, there was actually spectroscopic follow-up, some from our group, some from others. All of those, so about 10% were follow-up spectroscopically. All of them turned out to be normal supernovae. Although, if you go back to the circulars, there's a lot of excitement about seeing some feature that has never been seen before, but has been actually seen before in many supernovae. There's some interesting sociology. But in any case, this effort is going on, and it's just a matter of time until we have a much better localized event. And at least this gives me hope that we are doing follow-up observations that go deep enough to detect counterparts like 17.0817. Okay, so let me talk about host galaxies. This is a spectral energy distribution of the host galaxy of 17.0817, NGC4993, going from ultraviolet to infrared, along with kind of state-of-the-art population synthesis models. And the idea was to extract the star formation history of the galaxy, because the star formation history is essentially a proxy for the delay time between when the binary system formed and when it merged. So the star formation history is shown over there. You can see that, for as expected for an elliptical galaxy and a massive one, most of the star formation activity happened at early cosmic epochs, and it's been declining almost exponentially since then until the present day, when it's very low. So we can just invert that star formation history and ask, what is the probability distribution for the merger time of the binary neutron star, right? So in all likelihood, since most of the stellar mass of this galaxy formed about 10 billion years ago, then that's the more likely age of the progenitor, and it's unlikely to be fairly rapid merger. Okay, so that's shown on the other plot. And then, of course, we don't know the delay time distribution, so if we convolve it with the delay time distribution of t to the 0, t to the minus 1, we get a slightly different answer. But the merger timescale, the mean value is about 11 gigayears, plus or minus a few gigayears. And of course, then we can translate that into the initial separation of the two neutron stars, assuming that they've just evolved on their gravitational wave emission since that time. We don't know the initial eccentricity, but this is the blue line is a trajectory in the eccentricity initial separation plane. And you can see it in comparison to population synthesis predictions, as well as the galactic population of neutron star binaries. Okay, so this is great. It means we can take the properties of the host galaxies and learn something about the binary neutron star. Of course, from one event, you know, we can't do this alone. This is a statistical study. So we've looked at this question of whether we can actually reconstruct the delay time distribution by looking at the properties of the host galaxies of binary neutron star mergers in the local universe. And it turns out that it can be done in one of two ways. There are general scaling relations that correlate the star formation histories of galaxies to their stellar mass. So more massive galaxies tend to form their stars earlier on in cosmic history. Lower mass galaxies form their stars more recently. And so depending on how what the delay time distribution is, when we convolve it with this correlation, we get different distribution of host galaxy masses. Okay. The other one is to actually reconstruct individually the star formation history of each host galaxy of a binary neutron star merger. And again, we can see similar effects. Depending on what kind of galaxy it is and what its star formation history is, we can backtrack what the delay time distribution is from a sample of X number of host galaxies. Okay, so the question is, what is that X? How many host galaxies do we need? And so we've done this kind of study of injecting different delay time distributions that are characterized by different slopes and different minimum merger time, fairly simplistic delay time distributions. And you can see that in order to constrain these parameters in any reasonable way, you know, we need samples of order 100 or a few hundred host galaxies. Okay, how long is that going to take? I don't know. So far we have one. So it's possible that it will take 10 or 20 years to get that sample. Now there's another way to do this, which is by measuring the actual redshift distribution of binary neutron star mergers. So what's shown here is the redshift distribution measured for different delay time distributions for the LIGO and Virgo events. And you can see that essentially it all looks the same, except for a relative scaling, which is arbitrary. It all looks the same because we're looking at a redshift zero population. Okay? But if we're talking about third generation detectors that can see binary neutron star mergers out to redshifts one or two or three or four, now you can see that the redshift distribution that's measured depends very sensitively on the delay time distribution. So here we've asked the same question, how many events would we need in order to determine the delay time distribution parameters? Now here at these redshifts, we've made the assumption that we will not be able to find electromagnetic counterparts at these distances. And so each event will come with a distance uncertainty of order 30% or maybe even larger. But there are going to be a lot of them. Look at the y-axis there. 10 to the 5 mergers per year, right? That's scary. And so within about a year, even with this large individual distance uncertainty, the delay time distribution parameters can be measured to a few percent. Okay, so that's the alternative way of going about this. Okay, let me skip this and just put up these summary points. So I guess the main takeaway is that an event like 170817 carries a lot of information about these binary neutron star mergers and connecting the gravitational wave and electromagnetic information. We don't know yet how rare events like this are, but if we can build up these samples, we can study not only the physics of the events themselves and their ejecta, but also how these binaries actually form. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Ido. Questions?
So you said that there is a direct evidence, spectroscopic evidence for our process elements. Do you actually see lines?
Well, I think that that's...
I thought we don't.
That's what I tried to show in the infrared spectra, right? You don't see lines of individual elements where I can tell you that, you know, this line came from this element, this line came from that element. But I think the fact that these model, that the spectra match these models for our process dominated ejecta and do not look like any other supernova that we know of that's dominated by intermediate mass element, RNP elements, I would call that spectroscopic evidence.
Not direct one, but okay.
I was just struck by your statement that with third generation detectors, you could measure the delay time distribution to a couple of percent, but surely that's relative to the star formation rate, and I would be stunned if we ever knew that to better than 30%, given all the infrared corrections, bolometric corrections, et cetera, that go into that.
Yes, yes. Thanks for raising that point. So we're assuming a cosmic star formation history that's fixed, right? And then convolving everything relative to that, and it's about 10% uncertainty in the parameters relative to that. How much that's going to improve over the next 20 years, I don't have a good crystal ball for that. I don't know if it's 30% or better than that. It might, within a year, become the dominant uncertainty. Yeah, and I backtrack the whole thing, yeah.
Kind of a follow-up question, but is there any reason to believe that the parameters for the delay time distribution would change as a function of redshift, so metallicity dependence and things like that?
I don't know for sure. I would suspect that for neutron stars, probably not as much. For black hole binaries, I would suspect that would be the case. I mean, we heard this morning that metallicity effects come into play and changing the mass distribution and merger times and things like that. So for binary black holes, probably. For neutron star binaries, I'm not so sure. Again, I don't know that we have a good idea of what the dominant channel for these binary neutron stars are to begin with. So. Oh, yeah.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering how NGC 4993 or future host galaxies fit in with the sample of GRB host galaxies that we have.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So the, we have a sample now of order 40 or so short GRB host galaxies. As I mentioned earlier today, there are about two-thirds of them are star-forming galaxies, about a third of them are ellipticals. And this galaxy fits in kind of within the elliptical population of short GRB host galaxies. It's a bit more massive than the kind of typical short GRB elliptical that we find, but also that population is primarily between redshift of a half to one. This is redshift zero. There's a little bit of cosmic evolution. So I don't think there's anything that sticks out about this as saying, oh my God, this, you know, this can't be part of the same population. We just need to find more of these events. My expectation would be that as the sample grows, the majority of them would be in star-forming galaxies, not in these massive ellipticals.
Yeah, so you focused on this case where we don't have the EM counterparts, but of course, you know, with it, we will for whatever 1% or less have, yeah, maybe have GRBs if we fly. So I guess I'm wondering about, you know, the relative, you know, what you could get out of a sample of maybe, you know, out of this 10 to the 5 per year, if you could get, you know, 100 redshifts from GRBs versus what you're going to get just from gravitational waves.
Yeah, so we looked at that in the paper, and it depends on what you assume, right? So if you had 1% of the events with precise redshifts throughout this entire redshift range, then you can do better with that subset. But we've been successful at finding short GRB afterglows only to about redshift 1 or so. And so if I see if I can go back to that slide, redshift 1 just doesn't get you far enough in the distribution to, you know, redshift 1 is down where all the curves are still more or less on top of each other. So if you only have 1% of the events with precise redshifts, but only at the redshift 1, it's not helping you that much. So.
Hey, how does the mass and velocity of the kilonova ejector compare with those short GRBs like 13603b kilonova
ejector? Yeah, so for 13603b, we essentially have one data point that indicates that there is a kilonova there. It fits somewhere in a similar mass range. There's not enough information about velocity, and we don't know there if there is a blue component or not, because we have the afterglow emission at early time that is substantially brighter. So they're consistent, but there's just partly consistent because there's very little information for 13603b. I think it makes a good point, though, that while we're continuing to search for kilonovae associated with binary neutron star mergers, we shouldn't forget that we have this population of short GRBs that, at least for now, occurs at a higher rate. And so we should continue the effort of trying to find kilonovae associated with those events, just like we're doing here.
So I had a question about this slide. Is this delta z over z of 0.1 actually realistic? Because
it's 0.1 times z. So,
sure, but is that,
so it balloons up.
But is that from LVC simulations?
This is for 3G, yeah. So this is from simulations of what's expected for cosmic explorers plus ET that CNU
is. But at least in O3, their redshift estimates have been much worse, right? It's like 300 plus minus 100, 150 plus minus 50. So it's.
Yeah, so I think, I think it really honestly doesn't matter what happens at low redshift here because all the curves are converged.
Right.
But I'll let CNU talk about this more because I think there is actually some interesting.
Okay. So we've done a simulation of how well we can estimate the distance for 3G, and yeah, we also cross-check with rapid and low inference code. So I think this
is a subset of loud events. Is this making any assumptions, or will it always, will every event be yes within 0.1?
I think it's a good fit for all of the events that we will see. But it's not like exact, but it's a good fit for the behavior.
Okay, let's thank Ido again.